Disc 10.
It's their version of stealth radar, which is quite stupid because they haven't perfected it yet. But the North Koreans are even dumber because they're paying for it. They'll buy anything from France, especially if the French try to hide it. The French, of course, know this, so it's all cloak and dagger, and the North Koreans pay top dollar. The president pushed a button, and the waiter appeared to remove their plates. Another brought chicken and pasta. "How's your health?" the president asked. "About the same. I'll probably leave when you do." This pleased them both, the prospect of the other leaving. For no apparent reason, the president then launched into a windy narrative about his vice president and what a wonderful job he would do in the Oval Office. He ignored his lunch and became very earnest in his opinions of what a fine human being and brilliant thinker and capable leader the man was. Teddy played with his chicken. "How do you see the race?" the president asked. "I honestly don't care," Teddy said, lying again. "As I told you, I'm leaving Washington when you do, Mr. President. I'm retiring to my little farm, where there's no television, no newspapers, nothing but a little fishing and a lot of rest. I'm tired, sir." "Aaron Lake scares me," the president said. "You don't know the half of it," Teddy thought. "Why?" he asked, taking a bite. "Eat and let him talk." "A single issue, nothing but defense. You give the Pentagon unlimited resources, and they'll waste enough to feed the Third World. And all this money worries me." "It never worried you before." The last thing Teddy wanted was a long, useless conversation about politics. They were wasting time. The sooner he finished his business, the sooner he could return to the safety of Langley. "I'm here to ask a favor," he said slowly. "Yes, I know. What can I do for you?" The president was smiling and chewing, enjoying both the chicken and the rare moment of having the upper hand. "It's a little out of the ordinary. I'd like clemency for 3 federal prisoners." The chewing and smiling stopped, not out of shock, but out of confusion. Clemency was usually a simple matter unless it involved spies or terrorists or infamous politicians. "Spies?" the president asked. "No, judges. One from California, one from Texas, one from Mississippi. They're serving their time together in a federal prison in Florida."
"Judges?"
"Yes, Mr. President." "Do I know these people?" "I doubt it. The one from California was once the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court out there. He got himself recalled, then had a little trouble with the IRS.
"I think I remember that."
"He was convicted of tax evasion and sentenced to 7 years. He's served 2. The one from Texas was a trial judge, a Reagan appointee. He got drunk and killed a couple of hikers in Yellowstone."
"I do remember that, but vaguely."
"It was several years ago. The one from Mississippi was a justice of the peace who got caught embezzling bingo profits."
"I must have missed that one."
There was a long pause as they considered the questions. The president was bewildered and not sure where to start. Teddy wasn't sure what was coming, so they finished eating in silence. Neither wanted dessert. The request was an easy one, at least for the president. The felons were virtually unknown, as were their victims. Any fallout would be quick and painless, especially for a politician whose career was less than 7 months from being over. He'd been pressured to grant far more difficult pardons. The Russians always had a few spies they lobbied to get back. There were 2 Mexican businessmen locked away in Idaho for drug trafficking, and every time a treaty of some sort was on the table, their clemency became an issue. There was a Canadian Jew serving a life sentence for spying, and the Israelis were determined to get him out. 3 unknown judges? The president could sign his name 3 times and the matter would be over. Teddy would owe him. It would be a simple matter.
But that was no reason to make things easy for Teddy.
I'm sure there's a good reason for this request, he said.
Of course.
A matter of grave national security?
Not really. Just a few favors for old friends.
Old friends? Do you know these men?
No, but I know they're friends.
The lie was so obvious, the president almost jumped at it. How could Teddy know the friends of three judges who just happened to be serving time together? Nothing would come from grilling Teddy Maynard, nothing but frustration, and the president would not stoop that low. He would not beg for information he'd never get. Whatever Teddy's motives were, he would take them to his grave.
This is a bit confusing, the president said with a shrug.
I know. Let's leave it at that.
What's the fallout?
Not much. The families of the two kids who were killed in Yellowstone might squawk, and I wouldn't blame them.
How long ago was it?
3.5 years.
You want me to pardon a Republican federal judge?
He's not a Republican now, Mr. President. They have to swear off politics once they take the bench. Now that he's been convicted, he can't even vote. I'm sure if you granted clemency, he'd become a big fan of yours.
I'm sure he would.
If it'll make matters easier, these gentlemen will agree to leave the country for at least 2 years.
Why?
It might look bad if they return home. Folks will know that they somehow got out early. This can be kept very quiet.
Did the judge from California pay the taxes he tried to evade?
He did.
And did the guy from Mississippi repay the money he stole?
Yes, sir.
All the questions were superficial. He had to ask something. The last favor had dealt with nuclear spying. The CIA had a report documenting widespread infiltration of Chinese spies in and through virtually all levels of the U.S. nuclear arms program. The president learned of the report just days before he was scheduled to visit China for a highly touted summit. He asked Teddy to come have lunch, and over the same chicken and pasta, he asked that the report be held for a few weeks. Teddy agreed. Later, he wanted the report modified to place more blame on prior administrations. Teddy rewrote it himself. When it was finally released, the president deflected most of the blame. Chinese spying and national security versus three obscure ex-judges. Teddy knew he would get the pardons. If they leave the country, where will they go? The president asked.
We're not sure yet.
The waiter brought coffee. When he was gone, the president asked, "Will this in any way hurt the vice president?" And with the same expressionless face, Teddy said,
"No, how could it?"
"You tell me. I have no clue what you're doing."
"There's nothing to worry about, Mr. President. I'm asking for a small favor. With a little luck, this will not be reported anywhere."
They sipped their coffee and both wanted to leave. The president had a full afternoon with more pleasant matters. Teddy needed a nap. The president was relieved it was such a benign request. Teddy was thinking, if you only knew.
"Give me a few days to do the background," the president said.
"These requests are pouring in, as you might guess. Seems everybody wants something now that my days are numbered."
"Your last month here will be your happiest," Teddy said with a rare grin. "I've seen enough presidents to know."
After 40 minutes together, they shook hands and promised to talk in a few days. There were 5 ex-lawyers at Trumbull, and the newest one was using the library when Argrow entered. Poor guy was up to his elbows in briefs and legal pads, working feverishly, no doubt pursuing his last feeble appeal. Spicer was rearranging law books and managing to look sufficiently busy. Beach was in the chamber, writing something. Yarber was absent. Argrow removed a folded sheet of white paper from his pocket and gave it to Spicer.
"I just saw my lawyer," he whispered.
"What is it?"
Spicer asked, holding the paper.
"It's a wire confirmation. Your money is now in Panama."
Spicer looked at the lawyer across the room, but he was oblivious to everything except his legal pad.
"Thanks," he whispered.
Argro left the room, and Spicer took the paper to Beach, who examined it carefully. Their loot was now safely guarded by the First Coast Bank of Panama. Chapter 36. Joe Roy had dropped 8 more pounds, was down to 10 cigarettes a day, and averaging 25 miles a week around the track. Argro found him there, walking and pacing in the late afternoon heat. "Mr. Spicer, we need to talk," Argro said.
"Two more laps," Joe Roy said, without breaking stride.
Argro watched him for a few seconds, then jogged 50 yards until he caught up. "Mind if I join?" he asked.
"Not at all."
They went into the first turn, stride for stride.
"I just met with my lawyer again," Argro said.
"Your brother?"
Spicer asked, breathing heavily. His paces were not nearly as graceful as Argro's, a man 20 years younger.
"Yes.
He's talked to Aaron Lake."
Spicer stopped, as if he'd hit a wall.
He glared at Argro, then looked at something in the distance.
"Like I said, we need to talk."
"I suppose we do," Spicer said.
"I'll meet you in the law library in half an hour," Argro said, and walked away. Spicer watched him until he disappeared. There was no Jack Argro, attorney at law, in the Boca Raton Yellow Pages, and this initially caused concern. Finn Yarber frantically worked the unsecured phone, seeking directory assistance all over South Florida. When he asked for Pompano Beach, the operator said, "One moment, please," and Finn actually smiled. He scribbled down the number, then dialed it. A recorded voice said, "You've reached the law offices of Jack Argro. Mr. Argro keeps hours by appointment only, so please leave your name and number and a brief description of the real estate you're interested in, and we'll get in touch with you." Finn hung up and walked quickly across the lawn to the law library, where his colleagues were waiting. Argro was already 10 minutes late. A moment before he arrived, the same ex-lawyer entered the room carrying a bulky file, evidently ready to spend hours trying to save himself. To ask him to leave would cause a fight and create suspicion, and besides, he wasn't the type who respected judges anyway. One by one, they retired to the small conference room where Argro joined them. The room was cramped when Beach and Yarber worked there, writing their letters. With Argro as the fourth man in, and bringing no small amount of pressure, the room had never felt so crowded. They sat around the small table, each able to reach and touch the other three. "I know only what I've been told," Argro began. "My brother is a semi-retired lawyer in Boca Raton. He has some money, and for years he's been active in Republican politics in South Florida. Yesterday he was approached by some people who work for Aaron Lake. They had investigated matters and knew that I was his brother and that I was here in Trumbull along with Mr. Spicer. They made promises, swore him to secrecy, and now he's sworn me to secrecy. Now that everything is nice and confidential, I think you can connect the dots." Spicer had not showered. His shirt and face were still wet, but his breathing had slowed. Not the slightest sound from either Beach or Yarber. The brethren were in a collective trance. "Keep going," they said with their eyes. Argro looked at the three faces and pushed onward. He reached into his pocket and removed a sheet of paper, which he unfolded and laid before them. It was a copy of their last letter to Al Conyers, the outing letter, the extortion demand, signed by Joe Roy Spicer, current address of Trumbull Federal Prison. They had the words memorized, so there was no need to read it again. They recognized the handwriting, that of poor little Ricky, and they realized that it had now come full circle. From the brethren to Mr. Lake, from Mr. Lake to Argro's brother, from Argro's brother back to Trumbull, all in 13 days. Spicer finally picked it up and glanced at the words.
"I guess you know everything, don't you?" he asked.
"I don't know how much I know."
"Tell us what they've told you."
You're running a scam, the three of you. You advertise in gay magazines, you develop relationships with older men by mail, you somehow learn their true identities, then you extort money from them. That's a pretty fair summary of the game, Beach said. And Mr. Lake made the mistake of answering one of your ads. I don't know when he did this, and I don't know how you found out who he was. There are some gaps in the plot, as far as I'm concerned.
It's best to keep it that way, Yarber said.
Fair enough. I didn't volunteer for this job.
What will you get out of it? Spicer asked.
Early release. I'll spend a few more weeks around here, then they'll move me again. I'll walk by the end of the year, and if Mr. Lake gets elected, then I'll get a full pardon. Not a bad deal. My brother gets a huge favor from the next president.
So you're the negotiator? Beach said.
No, I'm the messenger.
Then shall we begin?
The first move belongs to you.
You've got the letter. We want some money and we want out of this place.
How much money?
$2 million each, Spicer said,
and it was obvious this had been discussed many times already. All six eyes watched Argro, waiting for the twitch, the frown, the shock, but there was no reaction, just a pause as he returned their stares. I have no authority here, okay? I can't say yes or no to your demands. All I do is relay the details to my brother.
We read the newspaper every day, Beach said. Mr. Lake has more money than he can spend right now. $6 million is a drop in the bucket.
He has $78 million on hand with no debt, Yarber added.
Whatever, Argro said. I'm just the courier, the mail runner. Sort of like Trevor.
They froze again, with the mention of their dead lawyer. They glared at Argro, whose fingernails had caught his attention, and they wondered if the Trevor comment had been laid across the table as some sort of warning. How deadly had their game become? They were giddy with thoughts of money and freedom, but how safe were they now? How safe would they be in the future? They would always know Lake's secret.
And the terms of the money? Argro asked.
Very simple, Spicer said. All of it up front, all of it wired to some delightful little place, probably Panama.
Okay. Now, what about your release? Argro asked.
What about it? Asked Beach.
Any suggestions?
Not really. We thought Mr. Lake could take care of that. He has lots of friends these days.
Yes, but he's not the president yet. He can't lean on the right people yet.
We're not waiting until January when he's inaugurated, Yarber said. In fact, we're not waiting until November to see if he wins.
So you want to be released now?
Pretty damned quick, Spicer said.
Does it matter how you're released? They thought for a moment, then Beach said,
It has to be clean. We're not running for the rest of our lives. We're not looking over our shoulders.
Do you leave together?
Yes, Yarber said. And we have some definite plans on how we want to do it. First, though, we need to agree on the important things, money and exactly when we walk out of here.
Fair enough. From this side of the table, they'll want your files, all of the letters and notes and records from your scam. Obviously, Mr. Lake has to receive assurances that the secrets will be buried.
If we get what we want, Beach said, he has nothing to worry about. We'll gladly forget we ever heard of Aaron Lake. But we must warn you so you can warn Mr. Lake that if anything happens to us, his story will be told anyway.
We have an outside contact, Yarber said.
It's a delayed reaction, Spicer added,
as if he were helping explain the unexplainable.
Something happens to us, like, for instance, the same thing that happened to Trevor, and a few days later a little delay bomb goes off. Mr. Lake gets himself outed anyway.
That won't happen, Argro said.
You're the messenger. You don't know what will or will not happen, Beach said, lecturing. These are the same people who killed Trevor.
You're not sure of that.
No, but we have our opinions.
Let's not argue something we can't prove, gentlemen, Argro said, ending the session. I'll see my brother at 9 in the morning. Let's meet here at 10. Argro left the room,
left them sitting, trance-like, deep in thought, counting their money but afraid to start spending it. He headed for the track, but turned away when he saw a group of inmates jogging. He roamed the grounds until he found a secluded spot behind the cafeteria. Then he called Klockner. Within an hour, Teddy was briefed. Chapter 37. The 6 a.m. bell shrieked through Trumbull, through the corridors of the dorms, across the lawns, around the buildings, into the surrounding woods. It lasted for exactly 35 seconds, most inmates could tell you, and by the time it quit, no one was left asleep. It jolted them to life, as if important events were planned that day, and they had to hurry and get ready. But the only pressing matter was breakfast. The bell startled Beach, Spicer, and Yarber, but it didn't wake them. Sleep had been elusive, the reasons obvious. They lived in different dorms, but not surprisingly, they met in line for coffee at 6:10. With their tall cups and without a word, they walked to the basketball court where they sat on a bench and sipped in the early dawn. They watched the prison grounds. The track was behind them. How many more days would they wear their olive shirts and sit in the Florida heat, getting paid pennies by the hour for doing nothing, just waiting, dreaming, drinking endless cups of coffee? Would it be a month or two? Were they talking days now? The possibilities had robbed them of sleep. There are only two possible ways, Beach was saying. He was the federal judge, and they listened carefully, though it was familiar ground. The first is to go back to the sentencing jurisdiction and file a motion for reduced time. Under very narrow circumstances, the trial judge has the authority to release an inmate. It's rarely done, though. Did you ever do it? Spicer asked. No. Asshole. For what reasons? Yarber asked. Only when the prisoner has provided new information about old crimes. If the prisoner provides substantial assistance to the authorities, then he might get a few years off. That's not encouraging, Yarber said. What's number two? Spicer asked. We're shipped out to a halfway house, a really nice one where they don't expect us to live by the rules. The Bureau of Prisons has sole authority in placing inmates. If the right pressure is applied by our new friends in Washington, then the Bureau could move us out and basically forget about us. Don't you have to live in a halfway house? Spicer asked. Yes, in most of them, but they're all different. Some are locked down at night with strict rules, others are very laid back. You can phone in once a day or once a week. It's all up to the Bureau. But we'll still be convicted felons, Spicer said. Doesn't bother me, Yarber said. I'll never vote again. I have an idea, Beach said. It came to me last night. As part of our negotiations, we make Lake agree to pardon us if he's elected. I thought of that, too, Spicer said. So did I, said Yarber. But who cares if we have a record? The only thing that matters is that we get out. It won't hurt to ask, Beach replied. They concentrated on their coffee for a few minutes. Argro's making me nervous, Finn finally said. How's that? Well, he drops in here from nowhere and suddenly becomes our best friend. He does a magic trick with our money, gets it wired to a safer bank. Now he's the point man for Aaron Lake. Keep in mind, somebody out there was reading our mail, and it wasn't Lake. He doesn't bother me, Spicer said. Lake had to find somebody to talk to us. He pulled some strings, did some research, found out that Argro was here and that he had a brother they could talk to. That's awfully convenient, don't you think? Beach asked. You too, huh? Maybe. Finn's got a point. We know for a fact that somebody else got involved. Who? That's the big question, Finn said. That's why I haven't slept in a week. There's somebody else out there. Do we really care? Spicer asked. If Lake can get us out of here, fine. If somebody else can get us out of here, what's wrong with that? Don't forget Trevor, Beach said. 2 bullets in the back of the head. This place might be safer than we think. Spicer was not convinced. He finished a drink and said, "Do you really think that Aaron Lake, a man about to be elected President of the United States, would order a hit on a worthless lawyer like Trevor?" "No," replied Yarber, "he would not. It's much too risky. And he wouldn't kill us. But the mystery man would. The same guy who killed Trevor is the same guy who read our mail. I'm not convinced." They were together where Argro expected to find them, in the law library, and they seemed to be waiting. He entered in a rush, and when he was sure they were alone, he said, "I just met with my brother again. Let's talk." They scurried into their little conference room, closed the door, and crowded around the table. "Things are about to happen very fast," Argro said nervously. "Lake will pay the money. It'll be wired anywhere you want it. I can help if you want. Otherwise, you can handle it any way you wish." Spicer cleared his throat. "That's $2 million each." "That's what you asked for." "I don't know, Mr. Lake, but evidently he moves fast." Argro glanced at his watch, then looked over his shoulder at the door. "There are some people from Washington here to meet with you, big shots." He yanked some papers from his pocket, unfolded them, and laid a single sheet before each of the three. "These are presidential pardons, signed yesterday." With great reserve, they reached forward, took the papers, and tried to read them. The copies certainly looked official. They gawked at the bold letters across the top, the paragraphs of fussy prose, the compact signature of the President of the United States. And not a single word could be summoned. They were just stunned. "We've been pardoned?" Yarber finally managed to ask, his voice dry. "Yes, by the President of the United States." They kept reading. They fidgeted and chewed their lips and clenched their jaws and tried to quietly hide their shock. "They're going to come get you. Take you to the warden's office where the big shots from Washington will deliver the good news. Act surprised, okay?" "No problem. That should be easy." "How did you get these copies?" Yarber asked. "They were given to my brother. I have no idea how. Lake has powerful friends. Anyway, here's the deal. You'll be released within the hour. A van will take you to Jacksonville to a hotel where my brother will meet you. You will wait there until the wire transfers are confirmed. Then you will hand over all of your dirty little files. Everything. Understood?" They nodded in unison. For $2 million, they could have it all. "You will agree to leave the country immediately and not to return for at least 2 years. "How can we leave the country?" Beach asked. "We have no passports, no papers." "My brother will have all of that. You will be given new identities with a complete set of papers, including credit cards. It's all waiting for you."
2 years?
Spicer asked, and Yarber looked at him as if he'd lost his mind. "That's right. 2 years. It's part of the deal. Agreed?"
"I don't know,"
Spicer said, his voice shaking. Spicer had never left the United States.
"Don't be foolish," Yarber snapped at him. "A complete pardon, $1 million a year for 2 years to live abroad. Hell yes, we'll take the deal."
A sudden knock on the door terrified them. Two guards were looking in. Argro grabbed the copies of the pardons and stuffed them in his pocket. "Do we have a deal, gentlemen?" They nodded yes, and all three shook hands with him. "Good," he said. "Remember, act surprised." They followed the guards to the warden's office, where they were introduced to two very stern-faced men from Washington, one from Justice, one from the Bureau of Prisons. The warden completed the stiff introductions without getting any of the names confused, then he handed each of the three a legal-sized document. They were the originals of what Argro had just shown them.
"Gentlemen," the warden announced with as much drama as he could muster, "you've just been pardoned by the President of the United States."
He smiled warmly, as if he were responsible for this good news. They stared at their pardons, still in shock, still dizzy with 1,000 questions, the biggest of which was, how in the world did Argro scoop the warden and show them the documents first?
I don't know what to say, Spicer managed to mumble. Then the other two mumbled something else. The man from Justice said, The President reviewed your cases and he felt that you have served enough time. He feels very strongly that you have more to offer your country and your communities by once again becoming productive citizens. They stared blankly at him. This fool didn't know they were about to assume new names and flee their country and their communities for at least 2 years? Who was on which side here? And why was the president granting them clemency when they had enough dirt to destroy Aaron Lake, the man who was primed to defeat the vice president? It was Lake who wanted them silenced, not the president. Right? How could Lake convince the president to pardon them? How could Lake convince the president to do anything at this stage of the campaign? They clutched their pardons and sat speechless, their faces drawn tight as the questions hammered away inside. The man from the bureau said, You should feel honored. Clemency is very rare. Yarber managed to acknowledge him with a quick nod, but even then he was thinking, Who's waiting for us on the outside? I think we're in shock, Beach said. It was a first for Trumbull, inmates so important that the president decided to pardon them. The warden was quite proud of the three, but uncertain as to how the moment should be commemorated. When would you like to leave? He asked, as if they might want to stick around for a party. Immediately, Spicer said. Very well, we'll drive you to Jacksonville. No thanks, we'll have someone pick us up. Okay, then. Well, there's some paperwork. Make it quick, Spicer said. They were each given a duffel bag to collect their things in. As they walked rather briskly across the grounds, all still very close together and in perfect step, with a guard trailing behind, Beach said under his breath, So who got us the damned pardons? It wasn't Lake, Yarber said, just barely loud enough to be heard. Of course it wasn't Lake, Beach said. The president wouldn't do a damn thing Aaron Lake asked him to. They walked faster. What difference does it make? Spicer asked. It doesn't make any sense, Yarber said. So what are you going to do, Finn? Spicer asked without looking. Stay here for a few days and ponder the situation? And then if you figure out who's responsible for the pardon and maybe you won't accept it, give me a break. Somebody else is behind this. Beach said. Then I love this somebody else, okay? Spicer said. I'm not sticking around to ask questions. They ransacked their rooms in a mad rush, never slowing to say goodbye to anyone. Most of their friends were scattered around the camp anyway. They had to hurry before the dream was over or before the president changed his mind. At 11:15, they walked through the front door of the administration building, the same door they'd each entered years ago, and waited on the hot sidewalk for their ride. Neither of the three looked back. The van was driven by Wes and Chap, though they gave other names. They used so many. Joe Roy Spicer lay down on the back seat and covered his eyes with a forearm, determined not to see anything until he was far away. He wanted to cry and he wanted to scream, but he was numb with euphoria, sheer, uncut, unabashed euphoria. He hid his eyes and smiled a goofy smile. He wanted a beer and he wanted a woman, preferably his wife. He'd call her soon. The van was rolling now. The suddenness of the release had them rattled. Most inmates count the days, and in doing so know with some measure of accuracy when the moment will come. And they know where they're going and who's waiting for them there. But the brethren knew so little. And the few things they knew, they didn't really believe. The pardons were a hoax. The money was nothing but bait. They were being taken away to be slaughtered, same as poor Trevor. The van would stop any minute, and the two goons up front would search their bags, find their dirty files, then murder them in a roadside ditch. Maybe. But, at the moment, they did not miss the safety of Trumbull. Finn Yarber sat behind the driver and watched the road ahead.
He held his pardon, ready to present it to anyone who might stop them and tell them the dream was over. Next to him was Hatley Beach, who after a few minutes on the road began to cry, not loud, but with his eyes tightly closed and his lips quivering. Beach had reason to cry. With almost 8.5 years to go, clemency meant more to him than his two colleagues combined. Not a word was uttered between Trumbull and Jacksonville. As they approached the city and the roads became wider and the traffic heavier, the three watched the scenery with great curiosity. People were driving, moving about, planes overhead, boats on the rivers. Things were normal again. They inched through the traffic on Atlantic Boulevard, thoroughly enjoying every moment of the congestion. The weather was hot, the tourists were out, ladies with long bronze legs. They saw the seafood restaurants and bars with signs advertising cold beer and cheap oysters. When the street ended, the beach began, and they pulled under the veranda of the Sea Turtle. They followed one of their escorts through the lobby, where they caught a look or two because they were still dressed alike. Up to the 5th floor and off the elevator before Chap said, "Your rooms are right here, these three." He was pointing down the hall. "Mr. Argrow would like to see you as soon as possible." "Where is he?" Spicer asked. Chap pointed again. "Over there in the corner suite. He's waiting." "Let's go," Spicer said. And they followed Chap into the corner, their duffel bags bouncing against one another. Jack Argrow looked nothing like his brother. He was much shorter, and his hair was blonde and wavy, where his brother's was dark and thinning. It was just a casual observation, but the three noticed it and mentioned it later. He shook their hands quickly, but only to be polite. He was edgy and talked very fast. "How's my brother?" he asked. "He's doing well," Beach said. "We saw him this morning," Yarber added. "I want him out of prison," Jack snapped, as if they'd put him there in the first place. "That's what I'll get out of this deal, you know. I'll get my brother out of prison." They glanced at each other. Nothing could be said. "Have a seat," Argrow said. "Look, I don't know how or why I'm in the middle of this, you understand? It makes me very nervous. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Aaron Lake, a man I believe will be elected and make a great president. I suppose I can then get my brother out of prison. But anyway, I've never met Mr. Lake. Some of his people approached me about a week ago and asked me to get involved in a very secret and delicate matter. That's why I'm here. It's a favor, okay? I don't know everything. You understand?" The sentences were clipped and rapid. He talked with his hands and his mouth, and he couldn't be still. The brethren offered no response. None was really expected. 2 hidden cameras captured the scene and sent it immediately to Langley, where Teddy, York, and DeVille watched it on a wide screen in the bunker. The ex-judges, now ex-inmates, looked like freshly released POWs, dazed and subdued, still in uniform, still in disbelief. They sat close together, watching Agent Leiter give a splendid performance. After trying to outthink and outmaneuver them for 3 months, it was fascinating to finally see them. Teddy studied their faces and grudgingly admitted a little admiration. They'd been shrewd and lucky enough to hook the right victim. Now they were free and about to be well compensated for their ingenuity. "Okay, look. The first thing is the money," Argrow barked. $2 million each. Where do you want it?" It was not the sort of question they'd had much experience with. "What are the options?" asked Spicer. "You have to wire it somewhere," Argrow snapped back. "How about London?" Yarber asked. "London? We'd like the money, all of it, all $6 million, to be wired at one time to one account to a bank in London," Yarber said. "We can wire it anywhere. Which bank?" "Can you help us with the details?" Yarber asked. "I'm told we can do anything you want. I'll have to make a few calls. Why don't you go to your rooms, take a shower, change clothes? Give me 15 minutes. "We don't have any clothes," Beach said. "There are some things in your rooms." Chap led them down the hall and gave them their keys. Spicer stretched out on his king-sized bed and stared at the ceiling.
Beach stood in the window of his room and looked north, for miles along the beach, the blue water gently rolling onto the white sand. Children played near their mothers, couples strolled hand in hand. A fishing boat inched along on the horizon. "Free at last," he said to himself, "free at last." Yarber took a long, hot shower. Complete privacy, no time limit, plenty of soap, thick towels. Someone had placed a selection of toiletries on the vanity. Deodorant, shaving cream, razors, toothpaste, toothbrush, floss. He took his time, then changed into a pair of Bermuda shorts, sandals, and a white T-shirt. He'd be the first to leave, and he needed to find a clothing store. 20 minutes later, they reconvened in Argro's suite, and they brought with them their collection of files wrapped neatly in a pillowcase. Argro was just as anxious as before. "There's a large bank in London called Metropolitan Trust. We can send the money there, then you can do with it whatever you want." "That's fine," Yarber said. "The account will be in my name only." Argro looked at Beach and Spicer, and they nodded their approval. "Very well. I assume you have a plan of some sort."
"We do," Spicer said. "Mr. Yarber here will leave for London this afternoon, and when he gets there, he'll go to the bank and take care of the money. If all goes well, then we'll leave soon afterward."
"I assure you things will go well."
"And we believe you. We're just being careful."
Argro handed 2 sheets of paper to Finn. "I need your signature to start the wire and open the account."
Yarber scribbled his name.
"Have you had lunch?" he asked. They shook their heads. Lunch was certainly on their minds, but they weren't sure how to proceed. "You're free men now. There are some nice restaurants just a few blocks from here. Go enjoy yourselves. Give me an hour to start the wire. Let's meet here at 2:30.
Spicer was holding the pillowcase. He sort of waved it at Argro and said,
"Here are the files."
"Right, just throw them on the sofa there."
Chapter 38. They left the hotel on foot, without escorts, without restrictions, but with their pardons in their pockets just in case. And though the sun was warmer near the beach, the air was certainly lighter. The sky was clearer. The world was pretty again. Hope filled the air. They smiled and laughed at almost anything. They strolled along Atlantic Boulevard and mixed easily with the tourists. Lunch was steak and beer at a sidewalk cafe, under an umbrella so they could watch the foot traffic. Little was said as they ate and drank. Everything was seen, though, especially the younger ladies in shorts and skimpy tops. Prison had turned them into old men. Now they felt the urge to party. Especially Hatley Beach. He'd had wealth and status and ambition, and as a federal judge, he'd had what was all but impossible to lose, a lifetime appointment. He'd fallen hard, lost everything, and during his first 2 years at Trumbull, he'd existed in a state of depression. He had accepted the fact that he would die there, and he'd seriously considered suicide. Now, at the age of 56, he was emerging from the darkness in a rather splendid fashion. He was 15 pounds lighter, nicely tanned, in good health, divorced from a woman who had money but not much else to offer, and about to collect a fortune. Not a bad middle-aged rally, he told himself. He missed his children, but they'd followed the money and forgotten about him. Hatley Beach was ready for some fun. Spicer was also looking for a party, preferably one at a casino. His wife had no passport, so it would be a few weeks before she could join him in London or wherever he might land. Did they have casinos in Europe? Beach thought so. Yarber had no idea and didn't care. Finn was the most reserved of the three. He drank a soda instead of beer, and he wasn't as interested in the flesh passing by. Finn was already in Europe. He'd never leave, never return to his native land. He was 60, very fit, now with lots of money, and was about to bum around Italy and Greece for the next 10 years.
Across the street, they found a small bookstore and bought several travel books. In a shop specializing in beachwear, they found just the right sunglasses. Then it was time to see Jack Argrow again and finish the deal. Klockner and Company watched them stroll back to the Sea Turtle. Klockner and Company were weary of Neptune Beach and Pete's and the Sea Turtle and the crowded rental. Six agents, including Chap and Wess, were still there, all very anxious for another assignment. The unit had discovered the Brethren, plucked them from inside Trumbull, brought them to the beach, and now they just wanted them to leave the country. Jack Argrow had not touched the files, or at least they appeared untouched. They were still wrapped in the pillowcase on the sofa in the exact spot Spicer had left them. "The wire is underway," Argrow said as they settled into his suite. Teddy was still watching from Langley. The three were now wearing all manner of beach garb. Yarber had a fishing cap with a 6-inch bill. Spicer had a straw hat and a yellow T-shirt of some variety. Beach, the Republican, wore khaki shorts, a knit pullover, and a golf cap. There were three large envelopes on the dining table. Argrow handed one to each of the Brethren. "Inside you'll find your new identities, birth certificates, credit cards, social security cards." "What about passports?" asked Yarber. "We have a camera set up in the next room. The passports and driver's licenses will need photos. It'll take 30 minutes. There's also $5,000 cash in those small envelopes there." "I'm Harvey Moss?" Spicer asked, looking at his birth certificate. "Yes." "You don't like Harvey?" "I guess I do now." "You look like a Harvey," Beach said. "And who are you?" "Well, I'm James Nunley." "Nice to meet you, James." Argrow never cracked a smile, never relaxed for a second. "I need to know your travel plans. The people in Washington really want you out of the country."
"I need to check flights to London," Yarber said.
"We've already done that. A flight leaves Jacksonville for Atlanta in 2 hours. At 7:10 tonight, a flight leaves Atlanta and arrives at London Heathrow at 5:30 in the morning."
"Can you get me a seat?"
"It's already done, first class."
Finn closed his eyes and smiled.
"And what about you?" Argrow asked, looking at the other two.
"I kind of like it here," Spicer said.
"Sorry, we have a deal." "We'll take the same flights tomorrow afternoon," Beach said, "assuming all goes well with Mr. Yarber. Do you want us to handle the reservations?"
"Yes, please."
Chap eased into the room without making a sound and took the pillowcase from the sofa. He left with the files.
"Let's do the photos," Argrow said.
Finn Yarber, now traveling as a Mr. William McCoy of San Jose, California, flew to Atlanta without incident. For an hour, he walked the concourses of the airport, rode the underground shuttles, and thoroughly enjoyed the frenzy and chaos of being in the midst of a million people in a hurry. His first-class seat was a massive leather recliner. After two glasses of champagne, he began to drift and to dream. He was afraid to sleep because he was afraid to wake up. He was certain he would be back on his top bunk, staring at the ceiling, counting off another day at Trumbull. From a payphone next to Beach Java, Joe Roy finally caught his wife. At first, she thought the call was a hoax and refused to accept the collect charges.
"Who is this?" she asked.
"It's me, dear. I'm no longer in prison."
"Joe Roy?"
"Yes. Now, listen. I'm out of prison, okay? Are you there?"
"I think so. Where are you?"
"I'm staying at a hotel near Jacksonville, Florida. I was released from prison this morning."
"Released? But how..."
"Don't ask, okay? I'll explain everything later. I'm leaving tomorrow for London. I want you to go to the post office first thing in the morning and get an application for a passport."
"London? Did you say London?"
"Yes."
"England?"
"That's it, yes. I have to go there for a while. It's part of the deal."
"For how long?"
"A couple of years."
Listen, I know it's hard to believe, but I'm free, and we're going to live abroad for a couple of years.
What kind of deal? Have you escaped, Joe Roy? You said it'd be easy to do.
No, I have been released.
But you got more than 20 months to go.
Not anymore. Listen, get the application for a passport and follow the instructions.
Why do I need a passport?
So we can meet in Europe.
For 2 years?
Yes, that's it.
But Mother's sick. I can't just run off and leave Mother.
He thought of all the things he'd like to say about her mother, then let it pass. A deep breath, a glance down the street.
I'm going away, he said. I have no choice.
Just come home, she said.
I can't. I'll explain it later.
An explanation would be nice.
I'll call you tomorrow.
Beach and Spicer ate seafood in a restaurant crowded with people much younger. They roamed the sidewalks and eventually found their way to Pete's Bar and Grill, where they watched the Braves and enjoyed the noise. Finn was somewhere over the Atlantic, following their money. The customs agent at Heathrow barely glanced at Finn's passport, which was a marvel of forgery. It was well used and had accompanied Mr. William McCoy around the world. Aaron Lake did indeed have powerful friends. Finn took a taxi to the Basil Street Hotel in Knightsbridge and paid cash for the smallest room available. He and Beach had selected the hotel at random from a travel guide. It was an old-fashioned place filled with antiques, and it rambled from floor to floor. At the small restaurant upstairs, he had breakfast of coffee, eggs, and black sausage, then went for a walk. At 10, his taxi stopped in front of the Metropolitan Trust in the city. The receptionist didn't care for his attire, jeans and a pullover, but when she realized he was an American, she shrugged and seemed to tolerate it. They made him wait for an hour, but he didn't mind it at all. Finn was nervous, but didn't show it. He'd wait for days, weeks, months to get the money. He'd learned how to be patient. The Mr. McGregor who was in charge of the wire finally came for him. The money had just arrived. Sorry for the delay. All $6 million had crossed the Atlantic safely and was now on British soil. But not for long. I'd like to wire it to Switzerland, Finn said, with the proper dose of confidence and experience. That afternoon, Beach and Spicer flew to Atlanta. Like Yarber, they roamed the airport with unrestrained freedom while waiting for the flight to London. They sat together in first class, ate and drank for hours, watched movies, tried to sleep as they crossed the ocean. Much to their surprise, Yarber was waiting when they cleared customs at Heathrow. He delivered the wonderful news that the money had come and gone. It was hidden in Switzerland. He surprised them again with the idea of leaving immediately. They know we're here, he said over coffee in an airport bar. Let's shake them. You think they're following us? Beach asked. Let's assume they are. But why? Spicer asked. They discussed it for half an hour, then began looking for flights. Alitalia to Rome caught their attention. First class, of course.
Do they speak English in Rome? Spicer asked as they were boarding.
Actually, they speak Italian, Yarber said.
You think the Pope will see us?
He's probably busy. Chapter 39 Buster zigzagged westward for days until he made his final bus stop in San Diego. The ocean attracted him. The first water he'd seen in months. He hung around the docks, looking for odd jobs and chatting with the regulars. A charter boat captain hired him as a gopher, and he jumped ship in Los Cabos, Mexico, at the southern tip of the Baja. The harbor there was filled with expensive fishing boats, much nicer than the ones he and his father once traded. He met a few of the captains, and within 2 days had a job as a deckhand. The customers were wealthy Americans from Texas and California, and they spent more time drinking than fishing. He earned no wages or salary, but worked for tips, which invariably got larger the more the clients drank. A slow day would net him $200, a good day $500, all cash. He lived in an inexpensive motel and after a few days stopped looking over his shoulder. Cabos quickly became his home. Wilson Argro was suddenly transferred out of Trumbull and sent to a halfway house in Milwaukee, where he stayed exactly one night before walking away. Since he didn't exist, he couldn't be found. Jack Argro met him at the airport with tickets, and they flew together to D.C. 2 days after leaving Florida, the Argro brothers, Kenny Sands and Roger Leiter, reported to Langley for their next assignment. 3 days before he was scheduled to depart D.C. for the convention in Denver, Aaron Lake arrived at Langley for lunch with the director. It was to be a joyful occasion, the conquering candidate once again thanking the genius who'd asked him to run. His acceptance speech had been written for a month, but Teddy had a few suggestions he wanted to discuss. He was escorted to Teddy's office, where the old man was waiting under his quilt, as always. He looked so pale and tired, Lake thought. The aides vanished, the door was closed, and Lake noticed that no table had been prepared. They sat away from the desk, face to face, very close together. Teddy liked the speech and made just a few comments. "Your speeches are getting too long," he said quietly. But Lake had so much to say these days. "We're still editing," he said. "This election belongs to you, Mr. Lake," Teddy said quite feebly. "I feel good, but it will be a brawl." "You'll win by 15 points. Lake stopped smiling and listened hard. "That's, quite a margin. You're up slightly in the polls. Next month the vice president will be up. It will go back and forth until the middle of October. Then there will be a nuclear situation that will terrify the world, and you, Mr. Lake, will become the Messiah." The prospect frightened even the Messiah. "A war?" Lake asked quietly. "No. There will be casualties, but they won't be Americans. Natty Chenkov will get the blame, and the good voters of this republic will flock to the polls. You could win by as much as 20 points. Lake breathed deeply. He wanted to ask more questions, even perhaps object to the bloodshed. But it would be futile. Whatever terror Teddy had planned for October was already in the works. There was nothing Lake could say or do to stop it. "Keep beating the same drum, Mr. Lake, the same message. The world is about to become a lot crazier, and we have to be strong to protect our way of life." "The message has worked so far." "Your opponent will become desperate. He'll attack you for the single issue, and he'll whine about the money. He'll beat you up and score some points. Don't panic. The world will be turned upside down in October, trust me." "I do." "You've got this thing won, Mr. Lake. Keep preaching the same message." "Oh, I will." "Good," Teddy said, and closed his eyes for a moment as if he needed a quick nap. Then he opened them and said, "Now, on an entirely different topic, I'm a little curious about your plans once you get to the White House." Lake was puzzled, and his face showed it. Teddy continued the ambush. "You need a partner, Mr. Lake, a first lady. Someone to grace the White House with her presence. Someone to entertain and decorate. A pretty woman, one young enough to have children. It's been a long time since we had children in the White House, Mr. Lake." "You must be kidding." Lake was flabbergasted. "I like this Jane Cordell on your staff. She's 38, smart, articulate, quite pretty, though she needs to drop 15 pounds.
Her divorce was 12 years ago, and it's forgotten. I think she'd make a fine first lady.
Lake cocked his head to one side and was suddenly angry. He wanted to lash out at Teddy, but for the moment words failed him. He managed to mumble, "Have you lost your mind?"
"We know about Ricky," Teddy said very coolly, with his eyes penetrating Lake's.
The wind was sucked out of Lake's lungs, and as he exhaled, he said, "Oh my God." He studied his feet for a moment, his entire body frozen in shock. To make matters worse, Teddy handed over a sheet of paper. Lake took it and instantly recognized it as a copy of his last note to Ricky. "Dear Ricky, I think it's best if we end our correspondence. I wish you well with your rehab. Sincerely, Al." Lake almost said that he could explain things. They were not as they seemed. But he decided to say nothing, at least not for a while. The questions flooded his thoughts. How much do they know? How in hell did they intercept the mail? Who else knows? Teddy let him suffer in silence. There was no hurry. When his thoughts cleared somewhat, the politician in Lake came to the surface. Teddy was offering a way out. Teddy was saying, "Just play ball with me, son, and things will be fine. Do it my way." And so, Lake swallowed hard and said, "I actually like her." "Of course you do. She's perfect for the job."
"Yes, she's very loyal."
"Are you sleeping with her?"
"No, not yet."
"Start soon. Hold hands with her during the convention. Let the gossip start. Let nature take its course. A week before the election, announce a Christmas wedding."
"Big or small?"
"Huge. The social event of the year in Washington."
"I like that."
"Get her pregnant quickly. Just before your inauguration, announce that the First Lady is expecting. It'll make a marvelous story. And it will be so nice to see young children in the White House again." Lake smiled and nodded and appeared to like the thought. Then he suddenly frowned.
"Will anyone ever know about Ricky?" he asked.
"No. He's been neutralized."
"Neutralized?"
"He'll never write another letter, Mr. Lake. And you'll be so busy playing with all your little children that you won't have time to think about people like Ricky."
"Ricky who?"
"Attaboy, Lake, attaboy."
"I'm very sorry, Mr. Maynard. Very sorry. It won't happen again."
"Of course it won't. I've got the file, Mr. Lake. Always remember that."
Teddy began rolling himself backward, as if the meeting was over. "It was an isolated moment of weakness," Lake said.
"Never mind, Lake. Take care of Jane. Get her a new wardrobe. She works too hard and she looks tired. Ease up on her. She's going to make a wonderful First Lady."
"Yes, sir."
Teddy was at the door. "No more surprises, Lake."
"No, sir."
Teddy opened the door and rolled himself away.
By late November, they had settled in Monte Carlo, primarily because of its beauty and warm weather, but also because so much English was spoken there. And there were casinos, a must for Spicer. Neither Beach nor Yarber could tell if he was winning or losing, but he was certainly enjoying himself. His wife was still tending to her mother, who'd yet to die. Things were tense because Joe Roy wouldn't go home and she wouldn't leave Mississippi. They lived in the same small but handsome hotel on the edge of town, and they usually had breakfast together twice a week before scattering. As the months passed and they settled into their new lives, they saw less and less of each other.
They had differing interests. Spicer wanted to gamble and drink and spend time with the ladies. Beach preferred the sea and enjoyed fishing. Yarber traveled and studied the history of southern France and northern Italy. But each always knew where the others were. If one disappeared, the other two wanted to know it. They'd read nothing about their pardons. Beach and Yarber had spent hours in a library in Rome reading American newspapers just after they fled. Not a word about them. They'd had no contact with anyone from home. Spicer's wife claimed to have told no one that he was out of prison. She still thought he'd escaped. On Thanksgiving Day, Finn Yarber was enjoying an espresso at a sidewalk cafe in downtown Monte Carlo. It was warm and sunny, and he was only vaguely aware that it was an important holiday back home. He didn't care because he would never go back. Beach was asleep in his hotel room. Spicer was in a casino 3 blocks away. A vaguely familiar face appeared from nowhere. In a flash, the man sat across from Yarber and said, "Hello, Finn. Remember me?" Yarber calmly took a sip of coffee and studied the face. He'd last seen it at Trumbull. "Wilson Argro from prison," the man said. And Yarber put down his cup before he dropped it. "Good morning, Mr. Argro," Finn said slowly, calmly, though there were many other things he wanted to say. "I guess you're surprised to see me." "Yes, as a matter of fact. Wasn't that exciting news about Aaron Lake's landslide?" "I suppose. What can I do for you?" "I just want you to know that we're always close by, just in case you need us." Finn actually chuckled, then said, "That doesn't seem likely." It had been 5 months since their release. They had moved from country to country, from Greece to Sweden, from Poland to Portugal, slowly heading south as the weather changed. How on earth could Argro track them down? It was impossible. Argro pulled a magazine from inside his jacket. "I ran across this last week," he said, handing it over. The magazine was turned to a page in the back where a personal ad was circled with a red marker. "SWM in 20s looking for kind and discreet American gentlemen in 40s or 50s to pen pal with." Yarber had certainly seen it before, but he shrugged as if he hadn't a clue. "Looks familiar, doesn't it?" Argro asked. "They all look the same to me," Finn said. He tossed the magazine on the table. It was the European edition of Out and About. "We traced the address to the post office here in Monte Carlo," Argro said. "A brand new box rental, with a fake name and everything. What a coincidence."
"Look, I don't know who you work for, but I have a very strong hunch that we're not in your jurisdiction. We haven't broken a single law. Why don't you bug off?"
"Sure, Finn. But $2 million isn't enough?" Finn smiled and looked around the lovely cafe. He took a sip of coffee and said, "You gotta keep busy." "I'll see you around," Argro said, then jumped to his feet and vanished. Yarber finished his coffee as if nothing had happened. He watched the street and the traffic for a while, then left to gather his colleagues. This is Frank Muller. We hope you've enjoyed this production of The Brethren by John Grisham. This program was produced and directed by Bob Walter. Production copyright 2000, Random House Incorporated, all rights reserved. The book The Brethren can be purchased wherever Doubleday books are sold. This novel is a work of fiction. Any references to real events, businesses, organizations, and locales are intended only to give the fiction a sense of reality and authenticity, and not to describe any actual conduct. Any character's resemblance to an actual person, living or dead, is entirely coincidental.